My job is to show what's around the corner, that I've done a lot of different things. And because of it's like being in a horror movie and you just know, don't go in the basement, go to the attic. Or don't go in the attic, go outside in the backyard, because you've seen how the movie ends. You're the character that knows that.
Everybody, welcome back to the next episode of the Revamp Podcast. Super excited today to have a guest, our guest today, Brian Tully. Brian and I got to sit next to each other at a sales leader dinner recently and had some really interesting conversations around the table. And I was able to grab a few of the folks at that dinner for various episodes, and really excited that I was able to get Brian to fit us in. So, without further ado, Brian, why don't you introduce yourself to the folks at home? Tell them a little bit about your who you are, what you do, your background.
Sure. So my name is Brian Tully, currently the head of Americas for sales at LiveU. Prior to that, a little bit of history, did investment banking, reaching out Weston Lehman Brothers, did my own bootstrap startup with two friends and an accountant. We grew that from 0 to 21.4 million recurring SaaS revenue. And then we were purchased by Thomson Reuters. We then continued to grow that with a couple other pieces to about a $500 million division. Since then, I've been working with different startups in media tech, prop tech, video streaming, some other things, and basically helping them grow, helping them do transformative decisions. And whether it's as president or COO or CRO or SVP, it's basically how do you create the most amazing client journey from beginning to end, first message, BDR, all the way through. How do you make that align with your strategy, with your plan, so that everyone's going to be successful, including your customer?
Yeah, and I bet, I would imagine that nowadays, especially over the last few years, having that skill and that experience is probably very, very valuable to a lot of people. Use that word transformative or transformation. I think we're all kind of in a very transformative period. And we covered it in that dinner, and kind of everyone around the table had a very similar sentiment about how quickly things have shifted, and we all kind of have whiplash from a lot of things. So, I kind of wanted to talk to you about your experience of kind of going through changing market conditions, changing environments, and being kind of that transformative leader. One of the things we talked about, you had mentioned in your previous role, there were some decisions that you had made that ended up being, the correct decision, but I would imagine may have had some pushback or may have been a challenge to kind of get buy-in around. And I'd love to hear a little bit of the backstory there. I feel like it's really a learning insight.
Yep. So previous role was at Goldcast. By the way, Goldcast is an amazing company, video platform, webinar, AI, virtual snippets. Gotta check it out if you're doing any kind of virtual event or even hybrid event. So that's my plug for Goldcast. But when I first joined them, the founders, young founders, and I'll backstep a little bit. Basically, the past couple roles prior to LiveU, my job is to show what's around the corner, that I've done a lot of different things. And because of it's like being in a horror movie and you just know, don't go in the basement, go to the attic. Or don't go in the attic, go outside in the backyard, because you've seen how the movie ends. You're the character that knows that. So because of that, met the founders, and the founders are amazing people, and did a little bit of consulting. And the business problem was, how do we expand beyond our core demographic? How do we ensure that we hit targets? And then how do we basically onboard so that customers renew for a long period of time and we increase adoption? And all those were, challenges at the moment. Well, it's interesting because the first thing you do is you don't start with sales. You don't look at your sales numbers. You run over to clients. You run over to retention. You run over to what's working. And the ideal ones that you want, the clients that you want, why are they renewing? Which clients are not renewing? Why are they not renewing? And you need to have data and you need to be able to track all that. So we did. And when we did, we found out that there was an exact line where if you had this amount of employees, you renewed at a 2 to 3x ratio. If you were under that amount of employees, then you probably weren't going to do it because either you just ran out of funding or you don't have a defined marketing strategy or you're going international and you're just kind of winging it and hopefully it works. And if it doesn't work, you're not going to renew. So because of it, we basically immediately realized, wait a minute, we need to start going after a different client size based on employee. On top of trying to go to different industries, on top of other stuff. So that was the first thing is look at what's working, look at what success looks like when it goes all the way through the funnel, and then start backtracking from the funnel of what's working to what didn't work. Where did it break? Where did it break? Where did it break? Where did it break? All the way to your marketing inbound funnel and your BDR, and you step back that way. I'll pause there. Do you have any questions on that?
Yeah, I mean that's it's so fascinating because I feel like the gut kind of instinct of somebody, at least in my mind, is to look at the sales funnel and see what's closing and what's not. And there's that kind of inherent bifurcation where they don't even really consider that part. We were in this growth at all co costs mode where it was all about closing net new. And the idea that someone would come in and to fix this, the kind of revenue you're focused on who's renewing as opposed to who's closing, I think is obviously the correct move, but one that I think for a while people neglected because it just wasn't incentivized from the, let's say, investor class, something like that. Obviously, that's changed. I'm wondering, that approach. Was there immediate kind of buy-in from everybody about that, or was there pushback, especially from sales, where they're like, "Well, the smaller deals, that's our bread and butter, or you're taking that away from us?"
There was a lot of friction. So it's interesting because analytically, everybody saw the data and was like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. And they were like, yes, it's true. And the entire client team went, yep, this is true. This is fact. The real friction comes with, okay, now we need to change. Because if you've been out of college and you've been doing this for 4 to 8 years, you probably know one way of doing stuff. You have not been through the ups and downs. You haven't been through hyper growth, and then I need to worry about cash, and then hyper growth again. So because of it, it was when it's like, okay, we understand the problem. We all agree on that. Now here are the changes that we're going to make. And the changes were pretty drastic, starting with, okay, we're no longer going to go after these customers. We're only going to go after customers said that this. So that leads to multiple challenges. One challenge is, okay, I know how to sell these people. I know that they close really fast. And anything above this, I might know how to sell to a little bit, but then the other people, I have no idea what they do. I have no idea what their organizations look like because it gets more complex. And then on top of that, they don't know what the timetable is. So if you have monthly quotas or quarterly quotas, they're scared because you just change their whole pipe and the BDRs aren't going to be successful. The AEs aren't going to be successful. The investors are worried that, oh my God, if you do this and you literally are taking away 80% of the funnel as is and going after this thing that's not tried and true in this organization, are you going to be successful? That's a pretty big change. And depending on how much pressure is on your organization and how much cash flow you have, is the timetable you get to either slowly bleed it in or nope, I need to make a real hard pivot and we're all going to go along for the ride.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if it works, you're the genius, right? But history, business, let's say war or whatever, all kind of decision-making things is littered with people who, made kind of decisions that in retrospect, they tried to make a bold decision, and it went against them. But with the decision you were making, you had the data in front of you, right? I mean, it was the, you know, there was, this was not a gut feeling.
Well,
So,
half of it was in a gut feel. We
right.
knew it was working and not working, but could our team actively change and then flip their pipeline from 80% what we don't want to do to 80% what we do want to do instead of that 20%? Can we find it? Will they like us? That was a big leap. And that was a leap of faith that the executives and the board had to make, you know, along. And then probably 80% of the company got on board, but there's always 20% that there's also an emotional feel. These are the customers I like. These are the people I've been nurturing. You know, these are my peeps, and you are not with my peeps anymore. You know, you're telling me to leave them in their hour of need, and that's a hard thing.
So, after the, 80% kind of got on board, how difficult was that transition? Was it like a, was it a slow easing in, or was it like rip the band-aid off and sink or swim?
I wish we had time for a slow easing in. The original plan was, 6 months plus. We actually did it in 2 months.
Wow.
It was hard. It was a hard left turn
Yeah.
that we made. And everybody got on board and really worked together. And we also made major changes to the customer success side too, because it's not, if you're going to go after larger customers, it's not just the sales approach, it's not just message and contracting. Can you properly onboard them? Because let's just say a Goldman Sachs has a different onboarding strategy than XYZ Software with 40 employees. So, we had to make those changes too while we're doing this. And that actually compounds it because then you have, okay, I knew how to sell when it was three phone calls of support and this, and it was very simple. Now you're telling me there might be a project manager. And there might be this, and there might be a month and a half of stuff that we're going to do instead of a week. You know, how do I don't even know what you're talking about. So the constant enablement material cycle through to enable the sales reps and to enable the SDRs is essential, and to make sure that they are saying it correctly so that customer success is put in line for success so that the client doesn't go, I was promised this, and then they go over the wall and then we're like, what the heck are you doing? I was promised this. And that takes some iteration, but we actually got it right.
I mean, the this, I think traditionally, I'm sure you've seen this, where sales, success, these di different departments lived in completely different worlds, were incentivized differently, and having those incentives, sometimes they were, they worked against each other, which in, in the case you were talking about, they were incentivized to close deals. So that incentive kind of led them to close deals that may not have renewed as much. So when you made those changes, were was there a different set of goals or KPIs across the entire, let's say, go-to-market organization that everyone aligned to? Things like net revenue retention or renewal, that kind of thing.
Yep. And you, of course, you have to start with a project plan because you need the project plan to be signed off, a strategy, sales numbers, implementation numbers, percentages of customers that close, hours that they're going to take to implement them, hiring needs. You need to build all that up so that you can get signed off by the board so that the board trusts you, because then you have to go back to the board and say, look, we're in line with what we thought we were going to do, or we're behind or we're ahead, and here's why. And then you keep on going, and that builds confidence so that you can do the next round of changes when you need to. One example of what you were talking about is we had a certain number of opportunities we needed to create every single month, and we had a certain number of MQLs and SQLs that we needed to do. And we missed those, the SQLs, MQLs, we missed the opportunities, I think, 4 quarters in a row. And meanwhile, we overachieved quota every single quarter, like by 120, 130%. Like, it was a crushing. So after the second quarter of doing this, we actually went, okay, let's look at the data again. And what you found is that because we were going after this different demographic and because it actually worked, all of a sudden, I don't need to have four opportunities. I just need to have two, and the two are going to be at a 2x, 3x size, or it's going to close with this probability. And because of it, I'm actually going to be better off than if I had the four small or the four ones that were fragile to the two ones that were quality. So we actually created a weighting scale based on the opportunity, based on ICP, A, B, C, D. And if you close an A, that's worth 4 points. And if you close a B, that's worth 2 points. And if you really want to go after that stuff that we told you not to, that's worth 1 point. You know? So because of it, you kind of learn and you put that into practice and then run it through.
Yeah, I think the concept of the MQL is I think the biggest example of a KPI that could, you know, work again, you know, is benefits maybe one organization, but might be, you know, the opposite of beneficial to another, where it's like, you know, marketing wants is being incentivized on their MQLs. And so the MQL is kind of like whatever, you know, they decide, it's kind of arbitrary. And then, you know, it has all sorts of problems down the road. I've seen that happen in various forms across a lot of companies, but I was, you know, what was the qualification of the, you know, ABCD, was that just based on firmographic data of the company size, things like that?
So when we started, we created this giant Excel spreadsheet, you know, our Google sheet that was this long of all the factors that mattered. And it was size of company, and then it was industry, and then it was the technology stack that they used, and then it was other factors. And we had points for each one, and we populated our data lake. And we had a brilliant RevOps person, absolutely love him, that he basically would go in there and then create the weightings, and this is the people you're going to chase based on it. Well, that was the first 2 quarters, and it worked. We were going after the right people. But what we realized by Q3 is about 80% of that information really wasn't needed, had no effect on what we were chasing. And then we were able to boil it down to a list of about this. And if you were this, then you were good. Because none of the stuff really mattered afterwards.
Were the ones that actually mattered, did it surprise you, or was it counterintuitive, or was it the things that you would have thought those were the most important things?
Half and half. Some of it was employee size. And by the way, if you're a Fortune, you know, 50, that's actually not the best. It's actually, you drop it down to like Fortune 100 to Fortune 5,000. It's really the super sweet spot. Right. That was kind of natural. Industries, we had surprises. All of a sudden, we had four or five closes in an industry where like, that was a C. And after, you know, 2 months of reviewing it, we're like, maybe we should make it a B. And by the time it was 4 months, we're like, maybe that should be an A. And we kind of weighted it up, and we would weight the ones that we thought were great that weren't performing. We'd begin to weight them down. So it was constantly, you know, not changing everything. So if you change everything, you can't measure it. But if you flick a couple levers and then you kind of look at it, and you flick a couple levers, you can get to a good place.
So you were doing continuous iteration to optimize the model, which is, you know, I think super fascinating, because that speaks to being agile and adaptive to what the market is telling you, right? Like, I think a lot of people, there are people, myself sometimes included, that are so hard-headed that, you know, this is the idea, we're going to do this. And, you know, anything that tells you otherwise is getting blocked up. But it sounds like your approach was, start with the hypothesis and then see what the market's telling us, incorporate that into the model, and just kind of continuously evolve it.
Yes. And then to your point, I love that you brought up marketing and MQLs. I really see marketing and sales as one. You know, you should never be this. If anybody's saying, I created this many SQLs and, you know, you didn't close that, or I had this many opportunities, but, you know, they're all garbage, both of them are wrong. Mm. So it really is, figure out what really is going to work, your ICP, agree on it across the board, and then stick to it. So when the MQLs come in, it goes through the filter, and only the A's and B's matter. And if that means you only have to generate 200 MQLs, but they're A's and B's, and that moves the needle, oh my gosh, that's what you should be doing. And if you generated 10,000 other MQLs, that's fantastic. I hope they're wonderful people, but I care about these 200 here that are really going to move the needle. And then that way, when you hand it over to sales, you're like, okay, you know this is green. You have to now do your job and do this.
Yeah, really, really interesting stuff. Want to kind of, as we get towards the end of the conversation, I know that you recently started this new role. So kind of want to, as you're starting that role, what are you kind of seeing in the future? We're in the early stages of 2024. We just finished, we're in Q1 here. So what do you think the kind of challenges and opportunities that are going to be available to companies in terms of optimizing their go-to-market and the challenges that they may kind of incur?
Yep. So if I'm looking into the future, rarely are you going to build a 40-person BDR team anymore. What you're going to do is you're going to have a lead team of 5 to 10, and you're going to arm the hell out of them with the appropriate software. And the appropriate software could be that you have an auto dialer doing 10 calls of your ICP A's, and then you're picking up that way. Or a good example with video. You can actually use clay.io and a couple other things, stitch it together, and have an absolutely personalized video. A good example, this podcast, you could have you on the left and me on the right, and then I can use clay.io and put 100 of my customers on the right with their logo and chat because I've already ripped that off their LinkedIn. And I can make it look in their brand and colors because I've already ripped that off their website. And it's just like 30 API feeds smushed in. That's going to break the noise of the bombardment of emails of, hey, are you interested in this thing? Or, oh, do you have 2 minutes on LinkedIn? I do blah, blah, blah. If I see my face and I look like I'm in a webinar, I'm going to go, what? And that's enough to grab my attention. Then your message has to work. So I really think it's going to be a combination of automation empowering your reps. It's also going to be AI in order to, take over the first, second, third touch point to get you to where you need that really intelligent conversation where your sales reps are really going to take off, or your senior AE, senior BDRs can have a real intelligent conversation. That entry job is going to be tough now.
I mean, it's, there obviously. We've all kind of seen, especially in the tech space, there's been a lot of kind of reductions in force, and some of the murmurs are, oh, well, AI is taking these jobs. I don't think that's necessarily true, but in retrospect, it might be a little bit, because if those that are using AI correctly become more productive and they can 2x or 3x their productivity, and therefore you don't need, as big of a team, especially on, things that are early, a BDR, things like that. You can automate more intelligently some of the manually done tasks. Is that kind of what we're looking at, you think?
I think the AEs, especially the mid and senior AEs, and the solution consultants, the implementation, sales enablement, they 100% are safe for now, for the next like 5 to 10 years. It's more about the person who's just dialing for dollars, saying the same message with nothing different. That's the role that's being eliminated right now. And that's the role that I'd be worried about if I was out of college doing.
Yeah, I think it's a blessing and a curse. If you get into the job market now and you grind and you make it, and then you're going to be so well placed when, we're on an upswing again, wherever that is, to just thrive, but it's really tough. And I feel for them. But Brian, this was extremely fascinating, and I really appreciate you taking the time to chat. Before we sign off, is there, anywhere you want to tell folks to maybe learn a little bit more about you or your company, things like that?
Sure. If anybody is in the broadcast sports, if you're enterprise doing streaming video, your CEO wants to do a webinar from his house or beach house. Basically, LiveView does real-time transponding. So you can use one of its units anywhere on the planet. It will give you 4G, 5K through the internet. It will go where it wants to. You don't need a satellite or a truck or anything. And because of it, not only does it do contribution, it does the production, allows you to edit it, snip it real quick, and then it allows distribution. So a good example for broadcast, you can automatically post it out to 50 stations immediately. But you can also use that to broadcast all throughout your network internally and a lot of cool stuff. So by the way, they do the Super Bowl, they do the Olympics. You know, small stuff, but you know, Rob from Peter and you know, Rob from the rich give to the poor, and you know, everybody can use it, so it's cool.
Awesome. Brian, thank you so much, and I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Bye.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the next episode of the Revamp Podcast. Super excited today to have a guest, our guest today, Brian Tully. Brian and I got to sit next to each other at a sales leader dinner recently and had some really interesting conversations around the table. And I was able to grab a few of the folks.